Welcome to the Institute of Catholic Culture. We are a non-profit Catholic organization dedicated to the re-evangelization of our society through educational and cultural programs offered to the public at no charge. This presentation and many others are available through our online library at instituteofcatholicculture.org and on our ICC app. Please view our upcoming schedule of live online events and engage with us on social media. For handouts, links, and further study materials, please visit this program's page on our website or app.
Blessed is our God at all times, both now and ever, and unto ages of ages. Amen. Heavenly King, Consoler, Spirit of Truth, present in all places and filling all things, the treasury of blessings and the giver of life, come and dwell within us. Cleanse us of all stain and save our souls, O good one, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Dr. Reinhardt, it's all yours.
So this is night two of our journey through the Canterbury Tales. And I imagine most of you were here 2 weeks ago. In case anyone wasn't, I want to give the briefest recap before we jump into content tonight. So 2 weeks ago, we talked about the world of Chaucer, sort of the tumultuous world of the late 14th century. We talked about the Canterbury Tales as being particularly special because of the way they give this cross-section of society. It's not just the nobles, it's not just the elevated people, but it, like the Catholic Church, it's a little bit of a here comes everybody, and everybody's talking a whole awful lot. The concept we ended on last time was the idea of quieting, right? So we talked about how each tale, most tales, are really appropriate to the tellers, where they're revealing their character and you're seeing the world through their eyes. That's the first important principle, that the tale reflects the teller. But it's not just that the tales reflect the tellers, it's that the tales are in dialogue with each other. So we ended last time talking about the knight with his big chivalric romance tale, which then gets parodied by the miller, who takes the themes and the characters from romance and he makes this bawdy, vulgar, kind of funny story, right? And then the Reeve gets angry at the miller, and because he's angry at the miller, he takes the miller story and turns it into a nasty, vindictive, sort of gross story to get back at the miller. And this idea of requiting tales is really kind of at the heart of what the Canterbury Tales are doing. The cook is the last tale of what we call the first fragment. He tries to parody the Reeve, but he breaks off midway through the tale, and now that chunk of stories is done. We're moving on now. There's a story called The Man of Law's Tale, which we are not reading tonight. It's not the most exciting tale. It's about a woman named Constance, whose key defining feature is she is constant in adversity. It's basically, imagine a woman who has everything possible go wrong to her, but she stays faithful and she stays unflappable in her devotion to Christ. That's the whole story. After Constance comes the wife of Bath. And with the wife of Bath, we're starting something that we call Chaucer's marriage group. Now, a lot of the tales are involving marriage in some way, but the marriage group tales are obsessed with it. They're looking at questions of what makes a good marriage, who should wield power in marriage, is it even possible to have a good marriage in a fallen world? These are the sorts of things that we are very, very much interested in. The wife starts all this off by telling her sort of joyfully relativistic and self-serving prologue and tale. There are a couple of tales that we won't be reading, but then the wife's themes get picked up by the merchant, and he gives a massively cynical and disillusioned look at marriage. And then the Franklin is going to try to give us a satisfying resolution and sort of a happy conclusion to all these debates about, can marriage work? So that's sort of the outline for tonight. We're going to dive into it in just a second. But before we do, I want to give like 2 minutes of cautionary tales. Marriage is obviously a subject that we all probably care pretty deeply about, right? From the John Paul II generation on, marriage has been a defining thing that we care about in the Catholic Church over and against modernity. And this leads to some dangers. One danger in this is, I think I'll call it the danger of anachronism, all right? The Wife of Bath has been massively popular in graduate schools from the 1980s on because she's like this feminist icon who speaks her truth and doesn't let masculine authority shut her down. And okay, fine. I see it. But the Wife of Bath wouldn't see that. The Wife of Bath wouldn't understand what modern feminism is. She wouldn't care about what modern feminism says or does. And to project modern feminism back into the 14th century is kind of a mistake. In the same way, this is more for this audience, something that I have to be careful with my students. They love marriage. They care about marriage. They take classes on Christian marriage at Franciscan. But here's the problem. The marriage that they know and the family structure they know isn't exactly the family structure of the 14th century. All right? Here's what I mean. The medieval world is a different world. I think they're better than we are in all sorts of things. Now, they've got the same sacraments, but the culture and the trappings around these sacraments are a little bit different. How you get married is different. The age at which you get married is different. The expectations are different. And there are stresses on medieval marriage. Things like sometimes there's not due concern given for the individuals entering the sacrament. So you can have massive gaps in ages. Sometimes marriage becomes transactional, more of a business deal than a two becoming one under the watchful gaze of the church. There's also the weirdness in the Middle Ages that to be educated means being a clerk. If you're a university student, you are male and you're celibate. So there's this whole genre of university literature saying getting married is the dumbest thing you could do. Don't get married. Women are horrible. And you've got these stresses all sort of boiling in the background. All right. It's still Christian marriage, but it's not exactly our Christian marriage that these tales are going to be poking at and questioning. And with this, let's turn to the Wife of Bath. Now, one thing I asked you to do was to look at the wife's portrait in the general prologue. So this is on page 39. And if you go to page 39, starting around line 447, you get the portrait of the wife. I'm not going to read it all here. I'm not going to read it all now, but I will tell you a couple little things that you might miss if you don't pay very close attention. A massively interesting detail is that the woman is wearing spurs. Can anyone think why it's an interesting detail that this woman is wearing spurs on her horse? It tells you something about how she rides, all right? There are actually little drawings of the pilgrims in some of the manuscripts. The prioress is riding side saddle like a lady. The Wife of Bath is riding just like everyone else because she is an active go-get-em woman. She doesn't have time to ride side saddle. She's a woman on a mission. We're told that she's partially deaf, an odd little detail for the portrait, but we learn it's going to become very, very important in her prologue. There are a couple of other things that are so easy to miss if you don't pay super close attention and you don't know their world. So I'm going to read them to you because I think they're very interesting. All right, line 449. She had such a talent for making cloth that she surpassed the weavers, I'm going to mispronounce the town, of Ypres and Ghent. This is a tiny detail, but it's important. In Chaucer's lifetime, the King Richard II has to write to weavers around Bath with a royal edict censuring them for being so bad at making cloth. They are so bad at making cloth, the king says, that English merchants are endangered of their lives when they go and sell this very crummy cloth abroad. Okay? So what this means is the wife is from the worst cloth-making place in Europe. She tells us that she's better than anyone else in Europe. This is Dollar General claiming to be better than Saks Fifth Avenue. Okay? This is who this woman is. That's the first point. There's this second funny point that you get. This one, you don't need to know the Middle Ages to get. All you need to know is the Sermon on the Mount. In all the parish, there was no wife entitled to make her offering before her. And if one did, certainly she was so angry that she was out of all charity. So you would have formal processions for people to bring their gifts to the altar. the wife always has to go first because it's a rank thing. And if anybody cuts her off, she is completely out of charity. Now, you think about the Sermon on the Mount. If you're bringing your gift before the altar and there you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift, go be reconciled with your brother, and then come and offer your gift, right? That's the principle. The wife takes it, she turns it inside out, she turns it on its head, and this is going to be, sadly, kind of the key to her character. So that's enough on her portrait. I think it's worth going into her proper prologue in her tale. We are short on time. The wife of Bath casts a very long shadow, so we're going to spend most of our time on her tonight. But even with that, I don't feel bad about reading the first 30 lines of the wife of Bath's prologue. I want you to listen very carefully, see what you see. I won't be able to exhaust everything, so we can pick it back up in our discussion in a bit here. Experience, even if there were no other authority in this world, would be grounds enough for me to speak of the woe that is in marriage. And apologies, I'm on page 291. For my lords, since I was 12 years old, thanks be to eternal God, I have had 5 husbands at the church door, if I may have been legally married so often, and all were worthy men in their different ways. But I was definitely told not long ago that since Christ went but once to a wedding in Cana of Galilee, that by that example he taught me that I should not be married more than once. Also, consider what sharp words Jesus, God and man, spoke beside a well in reproof of the Samaritan. Thou hast had 5 husbands, he said, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. Thus he spoke, certainly. What he meant by it, I cannot say. But I ask this, why was the 5th man no husband to the Samaritan? How many was she allowed to have in marriage? Never yet in my life have I heard this number defined. People may guess and interpret the text up and down, but I know well, without a doubt, God bade us expressly to increase and multiply. That pleasant text I can well understand. If you can understand these first 29 lines, I think you've got pretty much everything about this woman. Let's walk through sort of point by point. She begins immediately by putting experience against the voice of authority. Now, there are 2 ways that you learn things. You either learn them directly by experiencing them yourself. As somebody points out, a scholar on the Wife of Bath, you touch the stove, you learn it's hot. That's experience. But there are other things that you can only come to learn by authority. I know that London is the capital of England, not because I've experienced that, but because I've been told, right? I know that Jeff is in Columbus, not because I've experienced that, but because I've been told. You have to take a lot on authority. But the wife of Bath says, authority, we don't need it. She'll appeal to it, but she says she doesn't need it. All she needs is her own lived experience. And she's going to cut off that other part of knowledge. David Williams, the scholar I was talking about, says, in cutting knowledge in half, the wife of Bath personifies divisiveness and fragmentation. And if I could add one thing to that very good statement, I'd say she's a lack of sort of integrated wholeness. You see this when she looks at scripture. Scripture is meant to be read according to letter and spirit. There's the letter, and the letter, St. Paul says, kills if you don't have the spirit which gives life alongside it. So the medievals say when Christ goes to Cana at Galilee, he blesses marriage, but there's a preference for only getting married once, which they say is shown by the fact that he only goes to one wedding in all the Gospels. And the Samaritan woman, there it's very clear what Christ is saying. He's correcting her, saying you've been married 5 times. The man who you're now with is not your husband. But the wife has no time for any of those things. She says, the interesting point is how many times the Samaritan woman could have been married and how many times would have been okay. If you read the Bible like a medieval person would, with letter and spirit, she's like somebody who throws away the corn and holds on to the husks. She gives away the grain and keeps the bran, and then she'll twist it. You see this when she talks about Solomon. She's like, Solomon had it pretty good. He had hundreds of wives. Could I have that many husbands? Maybe, right? God told us to be fruitful and multiply. I understand that. One of the very sad points about the wife of Bath, who claims that be fruitful and multiply is something she understands. How many kids does the wife of Bath have? She hasn't any, right? And this is the tragedy of this woman who puts forward her experience, puts forward her own will. She's an exceptional, exceptional arguer, but she's arguing all for her own will, and she's arguing all from this place of, I think, actually, sort of deep woundedness and deep brokenness. And the whole of the rest of the prologue in the tale is going to be showcasing that fragility papered over with bluster. So I think we can probably turn to her experience, because it'd be nice to get to some tales pretty quickly. We get 650 lines of the wife of Bath's marriage history. Five husbands she's had. Three of them were good. Two of them were bad. What makes a good husband in the wife of Bath's estimation? You've got to be old, you've got to be rich, and you've got to be easily manipulated. And this is what she boasts. She gives a masterclass on, I think we can call it, without fear of anachronism, gaslighting. She accuses her husbands of doing what she herself does. She manipulates them. Whenever she senses that they're going to chide her, she launches into a salvo of accusation. None of it true, but she says, if you argue first, if you insult the other person first, they're put off their guard, and you get your way. She says, you say this about me, you say that about me. And a bunch of this is sort of just standard husband-wife quarrely stuff. There are some things that make you a little bit more concerned. She says, on the one hand, it's ridiculous that you should ever accuse me of being unfaithful. On the other hand, there's this proverb. This is page 309, line 326. The wisest of all men is he that never cares who has the world in his hand. You should understand by this proverb that if you have enough, why should you care how merrily other folks fare? He who forbids another man to light a candle at his lantern is ungenerous. He'll have none the less light by heaven. If you have enough light, you needn't complain. What she's saying is, if I sleep with you as much as you want, how can you possibly complain if I sleep with whoever else I want to? You don't have any less. It makes no sense to forbid it. Someone can come light a candle at your lantern, and there's no fear. There's no delicate way to say this. This is very, very, very bad. The wife of Bath is actually articulating a contemporary heresy espoused by the aptly named Brothers and Sisters of Free Love. And she's espousing this heresy in this massive gaslighting speech when she's saying, there's no fear if I would ever be unfaithful. And by the way, if I were to be unfaithful, it would be completely, completely rational for me to do so. So that's our wife. Now, obviously, she outlives her three old husbands and inherits all their property. Then come the bad ones. The fourth one, she points out, was wicked and horrible. She hopes he can go to heaven because she was his purgatory on earth. He kept a mistress. She hated him. He probably hated her. But the saddest thing of all with all this, we learn that she's arranged her fifth husband before the fourth is even dead. And when her fifth husband is being carried to his grave in his coffin, husband number five is one of the pallbearers. And all she's doing this entire time is checking out the very attractive thighs and calves on the young man who is the pallbearer and lining up husband number five. But this is where the big turn comes in her life. She's unguarded. She's 40. This young man's 20. She falls in love with this young man and gives him all her property. And he turns out to be not the perfect husband. He's got his book of wicked wives. And this is something that I would not counsel anyone to have, but he'd been a student at university. He'd learned that women are basically the devil. So he's got his book of wicked wives, which he pops out by the fireside every night. And he reads to his wife about how evil women are. And here's this horrible woman. Here's that horrible woman. And eventually, Allison of Bath can't take it. She rips out three pages from his book. She punches him. He falls into the fire. He gets up. He punches her, breaking her eardrum, making her partially deaf. And then we get the massively bizarre conclusion to this long, utterly revealing prologue. She falls down, pretends to be dead, stands up, accuses her husband of having basically murdered her, and he says he is very, very sorry. This is line 813. He gave control of the property completely into my hand to have control of house and land. Top of page 335, and also control of his tongue and hand. And I made him burn his book right then. And when I had got for myself, through superiority, the Middle English word there is mastery, it's slightly better, through mastery, all the sovereignty. And he had said, my own true wife, do as you wish the rest of your life. After that day, we never argued. So God help me, I was as kind to him as any wife from Denmark to India, and as true. And so was he to me. So they have this big blow up. He completely surrenders to her, says, you take care of everything. And after that, we didn't fight anymore. And after that, I was kind to him, and I was true to him, and we were completely in love, and everything was great. I want you to file that away, because that's going to come back and be massively, massively important. The other sort of heart-wrenching confession that the wife gives in her prologue comes on page 315. This is line 470. When I remember my youth and my gaiety, it tickles me to the bottom of my heart. To this day, it does my heart good that I have had my world and my time. But age, alas, that poisons everything, has robbed me of my beauty and my pith. Let it go, farewell, the devil with it. The flower is gone, there is no more to say. Now I must sell the bran as best I can, but still I will contrive to be right merry. Husband number five is almost certainly dead at this point. So the wife of Bath says, all I can do is reminisce on the good times. I'm so grateful that I've lived a full, by a certain definition, full life. And now age has ruined everything. The flower of my youth is gone, but I've still got the husk. And I intend to get as much out of that as I possibly can. That's our tale teller. That's our prologue. I think it's probably time we go to the tale. Now, the Wife of Bath's tale is a retelling of a very old folk story. The folk story is called the Loathly Lady, or the Loathsome Lady folk story. It features a knight who is assigned for some reason to find out the secret to what women really want. Nobody will tell him until an old hag reveals the secret. He's forced to marry the old hag. After he does, he learns from her that he can have her beautiful or old. He can't make the choice, so he gives her the choice. Then she's beautiful, and everyone lives happily ever after. That's the standard story. One of Geoffrey Chaucer's friends, contemporaries, writes a lovely little version of the story called The Tale of Florent, where Florent is this great hero. A couple generations later, there's the story of Sir Gawain and Dame Ragnell, where Gawain is just the best hero, saving his uncle, King Arthur, by going on this quest. The Wife of Bath tells it a little bit different. Our knight is not in any way a hero. He is, no delicate way to say it, he's a rapist. He raped a woman, he's sentenced to death, but the queen comes in and says, no, we're not going to kill him. We're going to send him on an impossible quest to find out what women desire most of all. He's got a year, he rides around, he's asking all sorts of people, getting different answers, and the wife says, well, some of the answers were close. We do love to be flattered. Some of the answers were nonsense. We don't care about not gossiping. But none of the answers are right. So our nameless knight is going along, can't find the answer until he sees some women dancing in a circle. These are clearly fairy women. He comes, there's the old hag. She says, I will tell you the answer if only you grant me whatever request I will next ask of you. So he comes before the court. He comes before Arthur and Guinevere and says, this is page 347, line 181, the answer to what all women actually want most. So again, 347, 181. My liege lady, he said, generally women desire to have dominion, the Middle English word is sovereignty, over their husbands as well as their lovers, and to be above them in mastery. This is your greatest desire. Though you may kill me, do as you please. I am at your will here. And the queen and all the ladies say, he's right. So our knight is free. The two key words are sovereignty and mastery. The same words that popped up in the Wife of Bath's prologue. This is what women desire most, sovereignty and mastery in marriage. But now the other shoe falls. The old hag is there. She says, Sir Knight, I demand that you marry me. They get married. The wedding night comes. The knight is understandably not exactly eager to be a husband to the old hag. And what follows is one of the oddest lectures in the history of all lectures. She says, why don't you want to be my husband? And he says, because you're poor and low class and ugly and old. And then we get this sermon on the virtue of poverty and the meaninglessness of rank. And hey, old age should be respected. And as for ugliness, the old hag says, I don't have to be ugly. I could, she said, be beautiful. Here's the choice posed to the knight. By the way, usually the choice is this. I can be beautiful during the daytime and hideous at night, or I can be hideous in the daytime and beautiful at night. So you've got to choose when you want me beautiful. And then the knight gives the choice to the fair maiden and thus breaks a curse from her wicked stepmother. It's really a nice fairy tale usually. But the Wife of Bath doesn't tell nice fairy tales. She gives you this instead, page 357. Choose now one of these two things, to have me ugly and old until I die, and be a faithful, humble wife to you, and never displease you in all my life. So, option one, ugly, old, faithful, and obedient. Or you can have me young and fair, and take your chances on the flocking of people to your house because of me, or to some other place, it may well be. Now choose yourself whatever you like. So, old, ugly, obedient, and faithful. Young, beautiful, disobedient, and unfaithful. Those are your choices. The knight says, I can't possibly choose. I give you the choice. She says, you've given me sovereignty. And then we get the happy ending of the story. When he gives her the sovereignty, she says, I will be both beautiful and faithful. He kisses her, his heart bathes in bliss. And then at the bottom of page 357, she obeyed him in everything that might give him pleasure or joy. And thus they lived to the end of their lives in perfect joy. And that's my story. So that's our Wife of Bath. And again, I've given her the first 30 minutes here because she does sort of kick off the whole conversation. I'm hoping in 20 minutes we can have a good talk about why the wife tells that story and what it means for that woman to tell that story. But for right now, let's go ahead to the next tales in our reading tonight. So as the Canterbury Tales roll on, there are a couple tales that come between the wife and the merchant. We don't have to care much about them. We get a fight between friars and summoners. That doesn't matter. Our student, the perpetual student, the clerk, tells a very good story, which does refute the Wife of Bath, but it doesn't actually answer by giving a positive answer to her question. Then we get the merchant. And I want to invite you just to think for a second what you know about the merchant from the general prologue. The Wife of Bath was colorful, right? She has her habits at the offertory. She's got her sort of scarlet clothes. She's got the spurs, the gap tooth. She's got her her boasting. The wife of Bath is colorful. The merchant is someone who, unless you specifically reread his portrait for tonight, you will not remember. He is as bland and he is as boring as they come. We're told that his speech is solemn. So he's very stern. He talks a lot about his business deals. The most telling comment, though, is what we don't know. He is so reserved, so not effusive, we don't even know the man's name. Chaucer says, by the way, never caught his name, because he's not the person who reveals that much about himself. I ask you to remember this, because we're going to go to not the merchant's portrait, but the prologue of the merchant's tale. I want you to remember who he is. Reserved, quiet, solemn, and not revealing himself. The first words he says in his prologue, if you've got your books, this is page 371, the first 10 lines. Weeping and wailing, care and sorrow, I know well enough. Evening and morning, said the merchant, and so do many others who are married. I believe it so, for well I know that so it goes with me. I have a wife, the worst that can be, for even if the devil were coupled with her, she would master him. I dare to give my oath. Why should I repeat to you in detail her proud malice? She is a shrew in every way. Where did this come from? This guy has been triggered, right? He has been married for all of 2 months. He's clearly a middle-aged man, been married for the first time in his life for 2 months, and marriage has not turned out the way he expected it to. And so the guy who didn't even give you his name before says, I've got a marriage story I can tell you. And now he's coming to tell you his big marriage story. It's as bitter and as unhappy and as cynical and disillusioned as any story I can think of in all of literature. He begins by saying, once upon a time, there was an old knight. His life was really good. He did whatever he wanted. He would also sleep around. He had a fine life. But then the idiot got it in his head that he wanted to get married. He's past his 60 year. Maybe he was doing it for religious motives. Maybe he was growing senile. But he says it's time for him to get married. And all of this is said with a sneer. Then we come... This is a question I want for you guys to think about before Q&A later. We come to lines 23 through like 148. This is the marriage encomium. Encomium is praise poetry, praising something. We have 120 lines, which mostly look like they're praising marriage. It says, marriage is the greatest thing ever. Your wife will be such a help to you. Who can be as obedient, so faithful, and as attentive as a wife? If you go to, I'm just going to jump very quickly. At line 68, a wife is truly a gift from God, quoting the Old Testament. She'll always take care of you. Marriage is a great sacrament. Any man who has a wife can never be ruined. Ah, look at this. Adam is given Eve as a helpmate. Here you can see that woman is man's help and comfort, his earthly paradise and his source of pleasure. Marriage is the best thing in the world. And you have to ask yourself, how on earth can the man who 5 minutes ago was telling us marriage is the worst thing in the world, flee from marriage, my wife is the devil incarnate, or actually my wife would beat the devil incarnate, right? How can that guy 5 minutes later go into this, here are 500 great reasons for getting married. Wives do this, wives do that. Wives are perfect. Wives are awesome. There's almost certainly a way to reconcile it. For now, we'll just note that it's really, really weird. Even if you take the merchant as being straightforward in his praise of marriage, our knight, aptly named January, is kind of an idiot. He decides that he doesn't want to marry any woman who's been married before because that woman would know too much. He doesn't want to marry even a 30-year-old. He says 30-year-old's way too old. She can't be more than 20. And the way the merchant describes January makes him very arguably the creepiest man in the Canterbury Tales, right? You get the pictures of him fantasizing about having a young wife. You have him confessing the reasons why he wants a young wife. He wants the young wife because he wants heirs, because he wants pleasure, and because, don't you know it, young women are so malleable, he'll be able to control her in whatever way he wants. He ignores the voices of his wise counselors who say this is a very bad plan. He listens to the flatterers, and then he decides, eventually, he's going to marry the best young woman in all the town, whose name is aptly May. So you've got an old man marry a young woman. The merchant tells us he gives to her basically all that he has. He titles everything over to her. What we have here is the wife of Bath's life told from the husband's perspective. Does this make sense? Right? It's the same story. Old man, young wife, old man doting on the young wife. But now we're seeing it more from the old man's perspective, and he hates himself as much as he hates anyone else. So we go through the excruciatingly uncomfortable wooing of the young lady by the old man. We come to the really horrible conclusion of the poem. The knight has a young squire named Damien. He's also got a very, very special garden. If you want to see the depths of cynicism about marriage, I want you to turn with me to, oh gosh, I lost my place and now I feel very, very foolish. Ah, there we go. Line 894. All right. January has gone blind. He's got his secret enclosed garden that only he and his wife can ever enter. It's meant to echo the Garden of Eden. It's this perfect garden of pleasure, the man and the wife together. Damien, the squire who has seduced the young wife, who wants to get together with the young wife, is hiding there like a serpent in the tree. And here's what January has to say. Page 421, lines 894. Rise up, my wife, my love, my gracious lady. The voice of the turtle is heard, my sweet dove. The winter is past with its wet rain. Now come away with your eyes like those of the dove. Thy breasts are fairer than wine. The garden is enclosed all about. Come away, my lily white spouse. Beyond doubt, you have ravished my heart. O, my wife, I know no fault in thee all my life. Come forth and let us take our pleasure. I choose you for my wife and my comfort. And I hope we are alive to the biblical allusions here. You caught the allusions, yeah? All that speech is a mashup of the Song of Songs. This is the lover speaking to the beloved. It's Song of Songs 2:14. It's all through the songs. Come forth, my sister, my spouse. You are lovely. You have ravished my heart. You've got the most beautiful poetry of the Old Testament, arguably, which mystically is talking about Christ in the church, right? Put in the mouth of this foolish old man, this foolish, lustful old man, speaking to the wife who's preparing to cheat on him. And cheat on him she does. He sits at the base of a tree. She climbs up into the tree saying, a woman in my condition, she means pregnant, which she may or may not be, needs fruit. She goes up, she gets pears from the tree. Well, she doesn't actually. She sleeps with Damien in the tree. At that time, the king of the fairies, Pluto, gives him back his sight. He sees her, but she's able, like a good student of the wife of Bath, to convince him not to believe his lying eyes. And so he doesn't. And off they go together. He kissed her and hugged her again and again. He stroked her belly very gently. Odd suggestion of maybe an heir being there that may or may not be his. And he led her home to his palace. Now, good people, I ask you to be satisfied. Thus here ends my tale of January. God and his mother Mary bless us. So that's our second picture of marriage, which is just this snarling sneer at anyone who would be dumb enough to enter the estate of marriage, because it doesn't matter who's in control. it always turns out badly. Now, I know we're running short on time, but I can't end discussion of marriage by saying marriage is for fools and for suckers and everything is horrible and no one should get married, because that's not where Chaucer would want to leave it. We have our third and final marriage group tale come now from the Franklin. The thing you know about the Franklin from the general prologue is that he's sanguine. He's happy. He likes to be happy. He has goodwill to everyone. He wants everyone to get along really nicely. That's what it means to be the sanguine man. He's not happy with the idea of marriage being this mutual war between the spouses, marriage being just waiting to see who's going to cheat on who first, marriage being this battle for control. And so, over the objections of the host, he decides he's going to tell a story that's all about marriage. And here, my gosh, we get something that's very exciting. My students were so happy when we got to the Franklin's tale because it seemed to give maybe a way out. There's a beautiful woman named Dorigen. There's a noble knight, Arviragus. And if we go to the beginning of the Franklin's tale, this is page 449. He woos her and he wins her at last because of his great worth. And particularly because of his meek obedience, she took such pity on his suffering that privately she agreed to take him for her husband and her lord. Now, if you're a medieval, you recognize that there's a problem here. Because in courtly love, the lover is always the servant. In marriage, the husband is called to have headship. Because of this, there are medieval people who say you can't actually have love in marriage. It's impossible. But our Franklin says, nope. You totally can, and I'm going to show you how. Arviragus says he will never lord it over her on page 451. Dorigen says, sir, I will be your humble, true wife and give you my pledge until my heart stops beating. And this is what I can tell you. This is line 34. Those bound by love must obey each other if they are to keep company long. Love will not be constrained by mastery. That's domination. When mastery comes, the god of love at once beats his wings and farewell, he's gone. And women naturally desire liberty, not to be constrained like slaves. And so do men, if I shall tell the truth. You need patience and love. And oh my gosh, we've actually got somebody giving something like a Catholic view of marriage with mutual submission of the spouses, with love and patience, recognizing that you will at some point get angry at your spouse, but you don't need to make it a big fight. Everything seems really perfect. He cuts the Gordian knot of medieval love theory that says you can't be a lover and a married man at the same time by saying he was both in lordship and in servitude at line 66. Servitude, no, but it's the higher state of lordship. He had both his lady and his love, his lady and his wife too. We have squared the circle. We have shown how love and marriage can be together, and that's happily ever after. And we are 75 lines into the tale. So we are short on time, but we're going to see in the next 5-6 minutes here how our dear little Franklin is going to continue to try to solve the problems that were raised. We're going to get the same story. We've got a knight, we've got his lady, and we've got a squire. The squire Aurelius wants the knight's wife, just like in the tale that we heard from the merchant, right? And he's got an opportunity because Arviragus has to go away to do knightly things in England. Dorigen wastes away. She's weeping. She's got anxiety for her husband. Her anxiety fixates on the black rocks that litter the coast of Brittany. She's worried that his ship will wreck on them coming home and he'll be lost. Eventually, her friends take her away to a garden, just like we saw in the last tale. And just like in the last tale, the squire propositions the wife in the garden context. But Dorigen is awesome. She is not like May. She hears him speak. She thinks he's insane. She says, absolutely not. That's my final answer. No way. I will never be unfaithful. Fantastic. But then, jokingly, she says, fine, I guess I'll love you when you can make all the rocks vanish from the seashore. Then I'll love you. Not unlike the wife of Bath, Aurelius misses the real point of what was said and seizes on the point that's most advantageous to him. He says, she didn't say never. She said when the rocks were all gone. So we're going to summarize the story really quickly. We're going to end with the final question, and then I'll turn it over to you. Aurelius goes to a magician, promises him 1,000 pounds, which is far more money than he has, if he can make all the rocks disappear. The magician creates an illusion that makes it appear as although all the rocks have vanished. At this point, Aurelius goes to Dorigen and gives what is, in my view, the oiliest and the creepiest speech in all the Canterbury Tales. I think I'm willing to say that. Let's see. I need to find my place here. Line 595, Aurelius comes and says, hey, the rocks are all gone. I'm on page 481, line 595. I'm going to read. You identify the problems. Madam, well, you know what you promised. Not that I claim anything as a right. From you, my sovereign lady, accept your grace. But in a garden yonder, at such a place, you know right well what you promised me. Putting your hand in mine, you plighted your word to love me best. God knows you said so, although I'm unworthy of it. Madam, I speak it for the sake of your honor, more than to save my heart's life at this moment. I have done as you commanded me, and if you will, you can go and see. Do as you please. Have your pledge in mind. The rocks are gone. Dorigen is now in a pickle. She contemplates taking her life. She resolves that she will kill herself before giving way to this. But before she can kill herself, Arviragus notices something's wrong. He asks her what the story is. She tells him the sorrowful story. He says, well, you've got to keep your troth. Now, troth for the medievals is a much more important concept than it is for us. It's honor, integrity, virtue. It's why Sir Gawain and Sir Gawain the Green Knight is willing to let his head get chopped off, because troth matters so much. Arviragus says, your troth matters most. You go. You have to love Aurelius now. Dorigen goes to Aurelius, tells him the story. Aurelius says, oh my gosh, what a generous man. I will show him that a squire can be as gentle as a knight. And he says, Dorigen, I release you from your promise. Aurelius then goes to his friend, the magician, and says, I can't pay you everything. By the way, I didn't get the girl. The magician says, I'll show you that a student can be as generous or as gentle as a squire. Your debt is forgiven. And now our Franklin has done what he set out to do. He's given you a gentle story, showing you how love and harmony and marriage can go together. And he ends asking the question, which of the three was the best guy? Which of the three was the most generous? The knight, the squire, the magician. And with this curiously posed question, the marriage group and all of its controversies come to an end. So, those are our three tales. I am very much looking forward to the discussion. There's a lot that I could have said, but didn't say because I want to talk it through with you. But for now, I'm going to hand it over to Becky.
All right, Dr. Reinhard, we already have a page of questions coming in the back. So I'm going to start with one actually from your discussion questions because I really liked it personally. And so since I get to moderate, I'm going to ask it. So as we're reading on number two, the very last part of your discussion questions, is it possible to come up with a unified understanding of matrimony from the three tales?
So wait, you're asking me? I thought this was something they were supposed to answer.
I know, but I would like to hear your take on it. And then we'll kind of go from there. Maybe a lot of times when we start stuff like this, it kind of spurs something. And then we a lot of times have more questions come in as follow-ups on it. But I would like to start there this evening, get a little overview of your insight on that, and then we'll go from there.
All right. So I think I'd start off by saying this. You get an awful lot of negative definition, don't you? Right? Obviously, what the wife of Bath presents is something that is so tragically sad. It's sad that she was married off at age 12 to somebody who is massively older than her. That was the youngest possible canonical age in the Middle Ages to get married. That is sad. And then each story sort of becomes sadder for her. And you've got someone now who can only justify herself in terms of sort of self-assertion, self-will, and dominance. That's a broken human being and a very, very broken idea of what marriage is supposed to be. Similarly, who knows what the merchant's home life is like, but that picture of marriage is so cynical and so bleak, right? Somebody describes it as though you had Shakespeare's Iago telling you what marriage is all about. It's just this completely disenchanted, disillusioned view. Obviously, that's not the right thing either. The real question is what the Franklin gives you fully satisfying? If you read him really carefully, his first 70 lines, you see how much he's saying, this actually isn't a problem. This actually isn't a problem. This actually isn't a problem. All you need to do is have some patience. You need to learn how to suffer and to bear a little bit. You need to learn not to flare up, right? You need to learn that marriage won't always be perfect, but it's really, really good. And you can sort of have this rosy view. The question that I have about the Franklin, though, is this. If you know the medieval temperament scheme, right, the sanguine is the positive, happy-go-lucky optimist, right? Is this just the optimist's view, saying it's all fine, there are no problems, it can be okay? That's the first little anxiety I have. The second little anxiety I have is there are a couple different views of it. I really hate the ending of the Franklin's tale. I recognize that it's a folktale type, but Aurelius is not generous at all. First of all, he cheats at the bargain. He doesn't get the rocks away. Second of all, she said it as a joke. She said, when pigs fly, then he's like, I threw a pig off the building. The pig flew for 2 seconds, right? That's not actually satisfying at all. There's no generosity from Aurelius. Not really. You can't have a new oath supersede an old oath. So the oath of fidelity in marriage can't be broken by this oath, even if she made it earnestly. And then that final question, isn't it great that everyone's all friends now? Makes me feel like there's something that we're missing. And if I were to suggest the thing that's sort of missing, even from the Franklin's tale, which makes me so happy in so many ways, I think the cross is probably missing from it. And I think that's deliberate.
So as kind of a part of this whole view of marriage and as we're seeing it through these tales, we actually have two questions coming in. Deborah asking one, and then a second one coming in as well, asking like, Is what we're seeing here a positive view for the time of marriage? They don't really see any real pictures of good or positive marriage that we would consider. And then somebody else asking about this, is the only positive way to see this view of marriage in the acceptance of the suffering?
So I do think there's a lot to be said for the acceptance of the suffering. This is where I lament that we don't have the Clerk's Tale pulling everything together. So the Clerk's Tale is like this nightmarish Cinderella story where you've got the Prince Charming, Walter, marry the peasant girl, Griselda, but then he decides randomly to psychologically torture her and she's obedient to him in every possible thing. And at the end of the story, the clerk says, don't be like Griselda. That's not actually what I'm saying. But I am saying that if a human woman can conceivably be that obedient to a human husband, how much more, Christian, can you be obedient to Christ? So I think with that acceptance of suffering and with that acceptance of the cross, I think there's something that ties it together there. Chaucer is always going to make complete answers impossible, but I do think that's a good start.
Great. Thank you. Katarina on screen, go ahead and take yourself off of mute and ask your question.
Hi, Dr. Reinhardt. Thank you. I was wondering, is for the Franklin's tale, do you think Chaucer is kind of critiquing the idea of troth in any way, like the societal idea of troth?
So that's really tough, right? So obviously Chaucer isn't in a world that massively values troth. He probably knows the poem Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, so he would have some sense of the importance of troth there. He knows William Langland, so he knows the importance of truth in William Langland. And, oh gosh, the the thing that makes me crazy about the translation, they talk about honor, they talk about loyalty, and they talk about this. But the thing that you are absolutely, absolutely hitting is troth, troth, troth. It comes up so much in the Middle English and gets obscured here in the modern. So I'm hesitant to say that he'd be critiquing the idea of troth, although I'm open to being persuaded here. I'm hesitant to say that because in the first place, the Franklin is just, the Franklin so happily affirms it, that this is just the best way that anyone can possibly be, right? Now, maybe we're criticizing the rash oath. I could see that. There are other people. Let's see. Ian Robinson argues that it's actually the troth which takes up the suffering thing by saying, no, this fidelity and this integrity that's symbolized by troth is where Arviragus actually does have a moment of Christ-like sacrifice rather than just happy-go-lucky, everything's perfect. I think dialing down into troth would be a very, very fun thing to do in this tale. I've not done it, but I think someone should.
Dr. Reinhard, looking specifically at these tales that you assigned to us this week, are there any other tales that you would recommend us reading? This is coming in. I'm trying to figure it out how to ask it without just being like, yeah, be with us for all three sessions and then continue reading. But are there any specific ones that you would recommend reading that would help us understand this section, right? These middle readings that you gave us better.
So again, I think the very best thing that you could do is to read the excluded tale, which is the Clerk's Tale. Harvard has a website where you've got all the Canterbury Tales available for free with Middle English and Modern English line by line translation. So the Clerk's Tale, which comes right before the Merchant's Tale, is one that is absolutely, absolutely essential to the larger discussion of marriage. So I think that one would be good. The other ones that are excluded, Sumner and Friar and Squire from this section, they're not directly talking about marriage, so I wouldn't say them. One important one is the Nun's Priest Tale, but we're doing that next time. For those who are interested in the very heavy lifting, the Pardoner's Tale, which is actually a, you know, thousands of words treatise on penance in prose, will give you Chaucer at the most serious, without any irony, without any sort of veil or gloss. If you really want to know Chaucer's view on morality, the Parson's Tale is where you go. But that's a very, very heavy lift.
Thank you. We have another question coming in the back, talking about the knight, right? The one who had to go and answer the question for all the women and all the things. So it says this person is writing in and asking, the knight commits a terrible crime, but is spared the death penalty if he can find the answer to this question. Does his punishment, meaning that he had to marry the old hag, does that fit the initial crime that he was spared the death penalty for?
Oh, in a way, absolutely yes, right? In a way. There are two things that are interesting, though, right? One is, poor wife of Bath, you wouldn't expect this of her, but you just notice the poor girl who's raped at the beginning, we don't care about her at all. The wife of Bath just drops her. She's no longer paid attention. I think for the wife of Bath's own logic, the fact that this violent, bad man has been mastered by this old and now young woman is absolutely part of poetic irony, poetic justice, and also personal satisfaction. Yeah.
Oh, Ariana on screen. I'm going to save this one written in for next. Ariana, go ahead and unmute yourself and ask Dr. Reinhard your question.
I guess I'm kind of curious about, these are told by the pilgrims themselves. I guess what role do you think Chaucer plays, or how much do we get of his, I don't want to say bias, but maybe his commentary about each of their tales?
So he's going to give very little direct commentary on the tales himself, right? He'll have other pilgrims talk about the tales, right? So The clerk will refer directly to the wife of Bath, and the merchant will refer directly to the wife of Bath. And so you'll get the fact that the tales themselves have multiple different voices pointing in different directions, right? And that's one of the things that makes things a little bit tricky. Sometimes Chaucer will repeat something so often that you get a sense that he's actually very, very serious about it. Like when the fairy woman is lecturing the knight on their wedding night and says, "True nobility is a gift from God and can only be attained by living virtuously, and it cannot descend by virtue of blood." This is something that pops up a lot in Chaucer. It pops up in the Canterbury Tales. It pops up in his short poems. This is something that he seems very clearly to believe. So sometimes you can pin things down. Other times you're forced to say, okay, which three or four different tales, three or four different morals that are directly given, how do we sift them and how do we sort them? And that's part of the challenge, but it's also part of the fun.
Dr. Reinhardt, I'm gonna get through John's question writing here in the back. I'm gonna take pieces of it because it was long and hopefully do it justice. But if we need some extra clarification, maybe I'll add back in the long parts. So John writes in saying, that Chaucer does quote scripture in his retraction, "All that is written for our doctrine." And most modern critics wield the tales and the tellers as ways to run down the church and virtue. Is it not necessary that we cannot rest in sin, but move through to the heavenly and virtuous interpretation? To rest or revel in the sinful is completely misreading Chaucer, right?
To rest or revel in the sinful is completely misreading Chaucer. The short answer is yes. The longer answer is it's a little complicated, I think, right? I think it's a little complicated because he does say he does have his retraction, but in his retraction, he also says he retracts those of the Canterbury Tales that sunen unto sinna, that are allied to sin, that lead to sin. Right. He also retracts things that I'm really quite fond of, like Troilus and Cressida. He retracts that. So the retraction is a incredibly, incredibly difficult thing to know how to integrate with the larger reading of the Canterbury Tales. I would agree with John. I think the Wife of Bath's tale is something that you are meant to move past. And the people who get fixated on the wife as this voice that destroys all authority, as this voice that needs to be celebrated, as this vindicate, I think they are absolutely missing both the dramatic progress of the Canterbury Tales and the moral that Chaucer wants you to give. In the same way, I don't think he wants you to rest in the Miller's Tale, although C.S. Lewis said, and I think C.S. Lewis is probably right, that he primarily wrote the Miller's Tale to make people laugh. So it's a very, very tricky thing to balance the general progress of the tales alongside with Chaucer's own retraction, alongside with what comes in the Parson's tale at the end. Generally, though, the pilgrimage to the heavenly Jerusalem celestial is, I think, what it's all about. So I would agree with John on that.
Thank you so much. I know for our next session, for session three, that we have four tales, right, that we're preparing for that. The Pardoner's Tale, the Shipman's Tale, the Prioress's Tale, and the Nun's Priest's Tale.
So, yes, maybe.
Okay.
And here's where I wonder if I can indulge or impose on the audience's indulgence a little bit. Pardoner's Tale is an absolute, absolute must read. It would be a shame if you didn't do the Pardoner's Prologue and Tale. And I'll tell you right now, the Pardoner's Prologue and Tale, it's like the Wife of Bath, where we wind up revealing more about ourselves than we want to, maybe. So pay attention to that. Pardoner's Prologue and Tale, Nun's Priest's Tale is also an absolute must read. I'm considerably less enthusiastic about the Shipman's Tale and the Prioress's Tale. What I would actually recommend people doing is going to the Manciple's Tale on the Harvard website, because the Manciple's Tale is one of the final tales that's meant to unite everything together and bring it all to an end. And I might even give a handout from the Parson's Tale as well, because I think the Parson's Tale is worth being acquainted with. Is that horrible of me?
No, no, not at all. That's part of why I was asking that question, is because it's really good prep. And we've had a couple people just writing in general into our info at, not necessarily tonight, but we kind of hold on to the questions that come in for events from info at, and then we like to bring them to light here. And because there had been a few asking like, okay, of these four that we're tackling, what's the priority or what do you think we should really focus on? I wanted to make sure to bring that up this evening with you. And we can even put a link under this third session to the Harvard site so that people can also have an opportunity ahead of time to read that. So I will add that to the event page tomorrow so that people can have some time to go and kind of prioritize their reading before the next session.
Beautiful.
Not horrible at all. That's why I started with that. Wonderful. Dr. Reinhard, we're so grateful for the time that you've taken so far for two out of three sessions and looking forward to getting our reading in over the next few weeks to be prepared for the last session with us. So thank you for spending some time in discussion with us and also helping us get prepped for that third session so that we can be ready to go.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Will you please close us in prayer for the evening?
All right. Yeah. So you know what? Keeping with the Middle English prayer, this one is not Chaucer, but it's a Marian prayer from around 1490. So here we go. In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. O moder milda, maida undefiled, that way so wielda be not begiled, and ever exiled from Christ and his, ora pro nobis. O quena of grasa, most fera of fasa, of all solas leading the trasa, of that hecha fast that way not missa, ora pro nobis. O lade frey of hech de grey, that way moense thy son and they, and ever tobe where all joy is, ora pro nobis. That Christ usenda gras to amenda, ura tima mis spent way hennes wenda, and at ura enda to grant us blissa, ora pro nobis. Amen.
We hope you enjoyed this program from the Institute of Catholic Culture. Remember to download our app and share our online library with friends, co-workers, and family members. To learn more, get involved, and support the Institute's work, visit instituteofcatholicculture.org and visit us on social media.